The Truth About Angels, Chapter 11, Angels from David's Time to the Babylonian Captivity. David's Reign. The Ark remained in the house of Abinadab until David was made king. He gathered together all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000, and went to bring up the Ark of God. They sat the Ark upon a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, drove the cart. David and all the house of Israel played before the Lord on all manner of musical instruments. And when they came to Nacon's threshing floor, Uzzah put forth his hand to the ark of God, and took hold of it, for the oxen shook it. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God smote him there for his error. And there he died by the ark of God. Uzzah was angry with the oxen because they stumbled. He showed a manifest distrust of God, as though he who had brought the ark from the land of the Philistines could not take care of it. Angels who attended the ark struck down Uzzah for presuming impatiently to put his hand upon the ark of God. With a view to extending his conquests among foreign nations, David determined to increase his army by requiring military service from all who were of proper age. To effect this, it became necessary to take a census of the population. It was pride and ambition that prompted this action of the king. The object of the undertaking was directly contrary to the principles of a theocracy. Even Joab remonstrated, unscrupulous as he had heretofore shown himself. Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab. The next morning, a message was brought to David by the prophet Gad. Thus saith the Lord, choose thee either 3 years' famine, or 3 months to be destroyed before thy foes, while that the sword of thine enemies overtaketh thee, or else 3 days the sword of the Lord, even the pestilence in the land, and the angel of the Lord destroying throughout all the coasts of Israel. Now, therefore, said the prophet, advise thyself what word I shall bring again to him that sent me. The king's answer was, let us fall now into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, and let me not fall into the hand of man. Swift destruction followed. 70,000 were destroyed by pestilence. David and the elders of Israel were in the deepest humiliation, mourning before the Lord. As the angel of the Lord was on his way to destroy Jerusalem, God bade him stay his work of death. The angel, clad in warlike garments, with a drawn sword in his hand, stretched out over Jerusalem, is revealed to David and to those who are with him. David is terribly afraid, yet he cries out in his distress and his compassion for Israel. He begs of God to save the sheep. In anguish he confesses, I have sinned, and I have done wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? Let thine hand, I pray thee, be against me and against my father's house. The destroying angel had stayed his course outside Jerusalem. He stood upon Mount Moriah in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Directed by the prophet, David went to the mountain and there built an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings and called upon the Lord. And he answered him from heaven by fire upon the altar of burnt offering. So the Lord was entreated for the land, and the plague was stayed from Israel. The spot upon which the altar was erected, henceforth ever to be regarded as holy ground, was tendered to the king by Ornan as a gift. But the king declined thus to receive it. David gave to Ornan for the place 600 shekels of gold by weight. This spot, memorable as the place where Abraham had built the altar to offer up his son, and now hallowed by this great deliverance, was afterward chosen as the site of the temple erected by Solomon. From the very opening of David's reign, One of his most cherished plans had been that of erecting a temple to the Lord. Though he had not been permitted to execute this design, he had manifested no less zeal and earnestness in its behalf. The Lord, through his angel, instructed David and gave him a pattern of the house which Solomon should build for him. An angel was commissioned to stand by David while he was writing out, for the benefit of Solomon, the important directions in regard to the arrangements of the house. Solomon. The hearts of the people were turned toward Solomon, as they were to David, and they obey him in all things. The Lord sends his angel to instruct Solomon by a dream in the night season. He dreams that God converses with him. And God said, "Ask what I shall give thee." And Solomon said, "Thou hast shown unto thy servant David, my father, great mercy, according as he walked before thee in truth and in righteousness and in uprightness of heart with thee. And thou hast kept for him this great kindness, that thou hast given him a son to sit on his throne, as it is this day. Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this thy so great a people?" In addition to the cherubim on the top of the ark, Solomon made two other angels of larger size, standing at each end of the ark, representing the heavenly angels always guarding the law of God. It is impossible to describe the beauty and splendor of this tabernacle. There, as in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the sacred ark was borne in solemn, reverential order and set in its place beneath the wings of the two stately cherubim that stood upon the floor. Elijah. After his first appearance to Ahab, denouncing upon him the judgments of God because of his and Israel's apostasy, God directed his course from Jezebel's power to a place of safety in the mountains by the brook Cherith. There he honored Elijah by sending food to him morning and evening by an angel of heaven. Then, as the brook became dry, he sent him to the widow of Sarepta, and wrought a miracle daily to keep the widow's family and Elijah in food. Facing King Ahab and the false prophets, and surrounded by the assembled hosts of Israel, Elijah stands, the only one who has appeared, to vindicate the honor of Jehovah. He whom the whole kingdom has charged with its weight of woe is now before them, apparently defenseless in the presence of the monarch of Israel, the prophets of Baal, the men of war, and the surrounding thousands. But Elijah is not alone. Above and around him are the protecting hosts of heaven, angels that excel in strength. In the full light of the sun, surrounded by thousands, men of war, prophets of Baal, and the monarch of Israel, stands the defenseless man, Elijah, apparently alone, yet not alone. The most powerful host of heaven surrounds him. Angels who excel in strength have come from heaven to shield the faithful and righteous prophet. With stern and commanding voice, Elijah cries, "How long halt ye between two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him, but if Baal, then follow him." And the people answered him not a word. While Israel on Carmel doubt and hesitate, the voice of Elijah again breaks the silence. "I, even I only, remain a prophet of the Lord. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let them therefore give us two bullocks, and let them choose one bullock for themselves, and cut it in pieces, and lay it on wood, and put no fire under. And I will dress the other bullock, and lay it on wood, and put no fire under. And call ye on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of the Lord. And the God that answereth by fire, let him be God." How gladly would Satan, who fell like lightning from heaven, come to the help of those whom he had deceived, and whose minds he had controlled, and who were fully devoted to his service. Gladly would he have sent the lightning and kindled their sacrifices. But Jehovah had set Satan's bounds. He had restrained his power, and all his devices could not convey one spark to Baal's altars. Did God forsake Elijah in his hour of trial? Oh, no. He loved his servant no less when Elijah felt himself forsaken of God and man than when, in answer to his prayer, fire flashed from heaven and illuminated the mountaintop. And now, as Elijah slept, a soft touch and a pleasant voice awoke him. He started up in terror, as if to flee, fearing that the enemy had discovered him. But the pitying face bending over him was not the face of an enemy, but of a friend. God had sent an angel from heaven with food for his servant. "Arise and eat," the angel said. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baking on the coals, and a cruse of water at his head. After Elijah had partaken of the refreshment prepared for him, he slept again. A second time the angel came. Touching the exhausted man, he said with pitying tenderness, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee." And he arose and did eat and drink. And in the strength of that food, he was able to journey 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the Mount of God, where he found refuge in a cave. In the desert, in loneliness and discouragement, after his mountaintop experience on Mount Carmel, Elijah had said that he had had enough of life and had prayed that he might die. But the Lord in his mercy had not taken him at his word. There was yet a great work for Elijah to do. Through a mighty angel, the word of the Lord came to him. "What doest thou here, Elijah?" In bitterness of soul, Elijah mourned out his complaint. "I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." Calling upon the prophet to leave the cave in which he had hidden, the angel bade him stand before the Lord on the mount and listen to his word. As Elijah obeyed, behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains, and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. And it was so, when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle, and went out, and stood in the entering in of the cave. His petulance was silenced, his spirit softened and subdued. He now knew that a quiet trust, a firm reliance on God, would ever find for him a present help in time of need. When Elijah was about to leave Elisha, he said to him, "Ask what I shall do for thee before I be taken away from thee." And Elisha said, "I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me." And he, Elijah, said, "Thou hast asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if thou see me when I am taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee." And it came to pass, as they still went on and talked, that, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted them both asunder, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, the chariot of Israel, and the horsemen thereof." Elisha. In 2 Kings, we read how holy angels came on a mission to guard the Lord's chosen servants. The prophet Elisha was in Dothan, and thither the king of Syria sent horses and chariots and a great host to take him. And when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth, behold, an host compassed the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said unto him, Alas, my master, how shall we do? Fear not, was the answer of the prophet, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. And then, that the servant might know this for himself, Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see. The Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. Between the servant of God and the hosts of armed foemen was an encircling band of heavenly angels. They had come down in mighty power, not to destroy, not to exact homage, but to encamp round about and minister to the Lord's weak and helpless ones. It was not given Elisha to follow his master in a fiery chariot. Upon him the Lord permitted to come a lingering illness. During the long hours of human weakness and suffering, his faith laid fast hold on the promises of God, and he beheld ever about him heavenly messengers of comfort and peace. As on the heights of Dothan he had seen the encircling hosts of heaven, the fiery chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof, so now he was conscious of the presence of sympathizing angels, and he was sustained. Isaiah. In Isaiah's day, idolatry itself no longer provoked surprise. Iniquitous practices had become so prevalent among all classes that the few who remained true to God were often tempted to lose heart and to give way to discouragement and despair. Such thoughts as these were crowding through Isaiah's mind as he stood under the portico of the temple. Suddenly the gate and the inner veil of the temple seemed to be uplifted or withdrawn, and he was permitted to gaze within upon the Holy of Holies, where even the prophet's feet might not enter. There rose up before him a vision of Jehovah, sitting upon a throne high and lifted up, while the train of his glory filled the temple. On each side of the throne hovered the seraphim, their faces veiled in adoration as they ministered before their Maker, and united in the solemn invocation, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. An indescribable glory emanated from a personage on the throne, and his train filled the temple. Cherubim were on either side of the mercy seat, as guards round the great king, and they glowed with the glory that enshrouded them from the presence of God. As their songs of praise resounded in deep, earnest notes of adoration, the pillars of the gate trembled, as if shaken by an earthquake. These holy beings sang forth the praise and glory of God with lips unpolluted with sin. The contrast between the feeble praise which he, Isaiah, had been accustomed to bestow upon the Creator and the fervid praises of the seraphim astonished and humiliated the prophet. He had for the time being the sublime privilege of appreciating the spotless purity of Jehovah's exalted character. While he listened to the song of the angels as they cried, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory. The glory, the infinite power, and the unsurpassed majesty of the Lord passed before his vision, and was impressed upon his soul. In the light of this matchless radiance, that made manifest all he could bear in the revelation of the divine character, his own inward defilement stood out before him with startling clearness. His very words seemed vile to him. The seraphim dwelt in the presence of Jesus, Yet they veiled with their wings their faces and their feet. They looked upon the king in his beauty and covered themselves. When Isaiah saw the glory of God, his soul was prostrated in the dust. Because of the unclouded vision he was graciously permitted to behold, he was filled with self-abasement. This will ever be the effect upon the human mind when the beams of the Sun of Righteousness shine gloriously upon the soul. As the increasing glory of Christ is revealed, the human agent will see no glory in himself, for the concealed deformity of his soul is laid bare, and self-esteem and self-glorying are extinguished. Self dies, and Christ lives. Such was the prospect that greeted Isaiah when he was called to the prophetic mission. Yet he was not discouraged, for ringing in his ears was the triumphal chorus of the angels surrounding the throne of God. The whole earth is full of his glory. And his faith was strengthened by visions of the glorious conquests by the Church of God, when the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. Ezekiel. Upon the banks of the river Chebar, Ezekiel beheld a whirlwind seeming to come from the north, a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof as the color of amber. A number of wheels intersecting one another were moved by four living beings. High above all these was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it. And there appeared in the cherubims the form of a man's hand under their wings. The wheels were so complicated in arrangement that at first sight they appeared to be in confusion, yet they moved in perfect harmony. Heavenly beings, sustained and guided by the hand beneath the wings of the cherubim, were impelling those wheels. Above them, upon the sapphire throne, was the Eternal One, and round about the throne was a rainbow, the emblem of divine mercy. As the wheel-like complications were under the guidance of the hand beneath the wings of the cherubim, so the complicated play of human events is under divine control. Amidst the strife and tumult of nations, he that sitteth above the cherubim still guides the affairs of this earth.